and welcome back to the IBS Freedom Podcast. This is one of my favorite topics, honestly. But I am here, always joined by my co-host, Amy Hollenkamp, RD, extraordinaire, gut health guru.
Here I am. Hey, guys.
Yeah, here you are. Amy, we have decided to talk about the vagus nerve today. And ooh, what a juicy topic. Oh, by the way, my name's Nikki. I realized last week, by the way, have you ever noticed this? I always do such a good job introducing you, and then I just roll into whatever the topic is, and I...
Well, maybe I should introduce you. I just kind of, like, sit back and I'm like, hey, guys, I'm here.
Maybe partially the awkward buildup that I give you every episode. But yeah, just FYI, in case you don't know, my name's Nikki.
It's hard for me to meet your energy level, though. That's probably it. It's like, I need to jump in there, but it's like, you do such a good job with the intro.
I try.
I'm stunned into, I'm subdued with the level of excitement.
There we go.
But I think it's funny, too, because I've gotten some feedback from people, you know, random people talking about, like, oh, you guys should cover this, like, I'm enjoying it, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying it's all good, but I always say, oh, yeah, like, I'll run that by Nikki, and I feel like, I think you're like, listed as Nicole, too. Like, I think just, like, not processing.
Yeah.
So it's, we should probably do a better job of that.
Yeah, that's one of the perks of being named Nicole, but going by Nikki. I don't know. Nicole always sounded stuffy to me. I'm not a Nicole. I'm a Nikki.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, technically my license is under the name Nicole Denezza. And, like, you know, all my professional stuff is Nicole. But anyway, that is a side note. Today's topic, for those of you who tuned in to hear an actual topic and not us chit-chat, is the vagus nerve.
Mm.
So this is a pretty big deal, especially since last week we talked about the gut-brain connection. And this is really the major highway that connects the gut and the brain, right? So, Amy, I'll open the topic to you for some opening remarks, if you would. But let's start this vagus nerve conversation, and then we'll share some of our favorite therapeutic interventions and tools and tricks and things that IBS sufferers can use, hopefully, today.
Right. No, I agree. The vagus nerve is probably one of my favorite topics as well. I think we share that. I'd be interested too, as the more we talk about this discussion, hearing about the chiropractic side of things, mm-hmm. because I feel like the chiropractors are more hip to the vagus nerve, it seems, than other practitioners, which is cool. But I even remember sitting in a chiropractor's office and they had like a TV running with different things about chiropractic. And I remember being in high school and hearing them talk about the vagus nerve, like, in the office of the chiro that I went to. And it wasn't gut specific. It was just a traditional chiro. So I think that's cool. So I'd be interested to, like, hear about what you learned in school and, like, if that has evolved at all and that sort of thing. But, I think the vagus nerve is super fascinating. I do think there's a lot of discussion around it more in the gut health space from what I've seen more recently, like people talking about strategies to strengthen the vagus nerve. Like, I'm definitely seeing that more and more. It's something that's definitely associated with low vagal tone, which basically means like weakness in the nerve is seen with IBS and IBD. If that's weak, it's really hard for the brain to communicate effectively to the gut. And that's why it's so huge. But I think sometimes there's so much focus on the vagus nerve and less focus on the brain and the gut as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both communicating via the vagus nerve and both play a role in basically activating the nerve for us using the nerve. So I do think that that's a key point too, like before we dive too deep into the vagus nerve, like you do want to also, if there's a brain issue, if there's a gut issue, making sure you're addressing those areas as well and not just focusing on like hardcore on gargling and things like that activate the vagus nerve and like basically thinking that that's going to heal the whole brain gut axis. And I think that's I've seen sort of that mentality of late where it's like, okay, all you have to do is just gargle or something and everything in the nervous system's going to be aligned. But I don't necessarily think that's true. I think there's such like a complex communication between the brain, the gut, and the vagus that it gets a little bit complicated. But the way I like to think about the vagus nerve is that usually, as it weakens over time with things like IBS and it's not being used, those pathways become weaker and weaker and weaker, and it becomes easier to get stuck in that sympathetic type state, the fight or flight state, and it's so hard to get back into rest and digest the longer that the weakness in the vagus nerve has been there. So it can definitely be a crucial piece because if you start building that up and you eliminate things that might prevent you from activating the vagus too, like toxins and getting the gut in order and again strengthening the brain, like putting all the pieces together, I think it can make a huge difference for digestion and motility and all the key pieces that kind of keep SIBO away and keep your gut happy in general, if you're more of an IBS situation.
Yeah, and I think you made a good point. Like, you can't just whack at your vagus nerve and try to stimulate, 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 and forget the two things that are on either end. You know, it's kind of
Right.
like you could almost imagine it like a barbell. Like, the vagus nerve is just the stick that connects the two weights on either end of the barbell. So you can't just lift the stick a whole bunch of times and think that you're going to get very far. You also need to pay attention to the weight that is on either side of the barbell, right? So I think A, not just focusing on the vagus nerve for the sake of the vagus nerve in isolation while not doing justice to the other two pieces of the puzzle is a worthwhile conversation to have. And what I've seen too, I don't know, you'll have to share with me. Well, you don't have to, but I would like you to share with me your experiences. That sounds so bossy. But I would say I've had patients, and I've seen this online too, where people are like, okay, cool. I'm going to do vagus nerve stimulation. I'm going to gargle. I'm going to use a TENS unit. I'm going to buy an essential oil. I'm going to take a supplement. I'm going to do whatever. But it's almost like there's this effort to like force the vagus nerve to do what you want to do, or like muscle your way through. Like, come on, vagus nerve, do your job, darn it. But if you are, this is so hard to word. It's like you can't heal things by forcing your body into doing things. And I think that that's especially true for the vagus nerve because a lot of people, myself included, I think our vagus nerves get fried and our nervous system and our balance gets off kilter because we push through so much in our life. Like, we take emotions or things that we should say but we don't want to, and we just like bottle it up and shove it down. Or we, you know, we wake up and we're exhausted, but we go to work anyway. Or we, you know,
Right.
we're fatigued, or like we have a relationship that we are just like done with, and we muscle through anyway, and we grit our teeth through it anyway. And there's so much of that, especially in American life, but I think even the world largely, where we are forcing ourselves and forcing our bodies to do things that maybe we shouldn't. And then, you know, if we're doing a lot of that kind of stuff and not being mindful to that, like the stressors that are actually bogging down our vagus nerve, and then we're like, oh, and then I'm gonna take this supplement or rub this essential oil on to get that silly vagus nerve to do its damn job. It's like, oh, this is like another symptom of the greater issue. Like, you're trying to force your way through life in some of these situations that need to be rectified. And also you're trying to like force the vagus nerve to do its job when it doesn't want to do its job because it's overwhelmed. And maybe you need to take a pause and acknowledge that, like, you're overwhelmed too. You're stressed too. I don't know if you've seen that before, but I think this, like, mentality to just push through and push the vagus nerve to do its job can be a symptom of a greater picture.
Right, and I think too, I mean, I think what we're saying is pretty similar. Like even not focusing on the brain or the gut too, and just like going all in on the vagus nerve and like hitting that really hard. I think there's like a similar mentality, slight different, but I see the same people doing this that where they're kind of just focusing on the vagus nerve and like pushing. And you're right, it's almost like if you went from not exercising at all and then you're running, like all of a sudden you're like, I'm just gonna run 8 miles and do that 7 days a week, your body's gonna get burnt out. Yeah, I mean, I definitely see that. I always wonder about that too with things like TENS units and some of the vagal stimulators. Like, I don't know how you really calibrate that properly for the individual, and maybe there's a strategy. I just haven't really used those types of devices because they're pretty expensive, and I just, again, it's not something I typically use. Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. And I think too, in general, what I've seen is starting slow seems to help from a like a soreness standpoint. Like if I had someone doing singing, humming, and gargling, what I've seen, if they go too hard, they're like, oh yeah, my throat's sore. Like I actually feel sore doing some of this stuff. So I'm like, let's like slow it down a little bit and we can build up a little bit slower when it comes to your vagus nerve.
Yeah. And I think, like, with nerves and muscles to some degree, like, you can kind of think of them as a little bit analogous for one another in the sense that you would not go, like you said, you wouldn't go from leading a sedentary life to all of a sudden saying, I'm going to run 7 miles every single day, because your muscles would hate you and you would just fall apart. And the same thing goes for the vagus nerve. I've seen that where like people kind of want to go big or go home, which again, it's like that mentality of like muscling your way through life and like band-aiding stuff when you don't really want to acknowledge some of the stress that you're under. And I say that all from personal firsthand experience. I'm horrible at that too. But I think, you know, nerves need to take the time to like build up tolerance for things and like be more plastic or more pliable. And they literally build up like more protein and more neurotransmitters. And like it takes time to start using that machinery again. So whenever I send somebody home with a TENS unit, because I do use that as a vagal nerve
Oh,
tool,
nice. Cool.
like when I send people home with it, I tell them, you know, the handout I give you says that you'll probably get up to like 15 minutes. Don't start with that because you're going to hate me. Start with like 3 minutes the first day or two because it's like we're doing bicep curls and you haven't used your biceps in 10 years. And I don't want you to hate my guts. So I have had patients where they start like the TENS unit too quickly and then they just feel like kind of crappy and they can't put their finger on why. And I thought that it was because they did too much too soon. But you can't force any part of your body to heal, much less the vagus nerve, where it's part of that autonomic, non-conscious part of your nervous system. So you can't bamboozle it. You can't tell the vagus nerve, "Hey, Vagus, we're fine now. We're not stressed," and then like really be stressed. You know, like you can't trick it because it's not getting its information from the conscious part of your brain. It's getting its information from the rest of your body. And it knows damn well when you're frazzled or when you're actually in a good state for rest and digest. So, like, there's no fooling the vagus nerve. But that being said, sometimes I do find it beneficial to have people do things intentionally for the purpose of trying to get into more of a parasympathetic state or trying to get that vagal tone up. And it's just like exercising the muscle as a component of what we do and just like trying to get that plasticity again. So, I do use that sometimes with patients.
No, I think it's such a good point. If you have stressors coming from a lot of different angles, fix like trying to just focus on the vagus doesn't take away the stress that could also be affecting the could be reason why the vagus is down to begin with. In a way, it's you're not really getting to the root of why the vagus is disrupted. So that makes total sense to me. And when we were talking about going too hard on the Vegas, it reminds me of when I go and play softball and try to sprint for like the first time in like years. You know, I'm not usually sprinting. I do more weight stuff and like sometimes I run, but like sprinting is like I feel like my muscles are so angry after I sprint like 3 times to first base or whatever. So that's what it kind of reminds me of. If I did that over and over again, you're kind of frying out your muscles. And again, in a way, like that's what's happening with the vagus.
And it's so tough because I think that everybody, probably everybody who listens to this podcast, but everybody I've ever worked with, certainly, they want to feel better yesterday.
Right.
Right? Like, right. Yeah, and it's like, to their credit, a lot of these people are really passionate and excited. Like, when they hear of a new thing, they're like, whoa, the vagus nerve, and I can stimulate it? Cool. And it's this mentality of like, I want to feel better right now. So they go all in and they do something. But that's why I'm really cautious and I tell people, like, don't go all in. Again, A, because you can't trick the vagus nerve. We can right. try to get it to do some push-ups or try to do some bicep curls, but you also need to work on the foundational stuff too. There's no point exercising one part of your body and then like neglecting the rest of it.
Right. And I worked with a really bizarre case of a woman who was working with another physician. She was, working with a physician, and it was odd because I'd never heard this before, but the physician was like, oh yeah, all you have to do is be on this TENS unit and your SIBO will go away. Like, this is all you have to do. So then I feel like there was not as much like interest in doing some of the other, like she was buying into what you're saying, like this miraculous idea that, you know, which again, it certainly could be helpful as a comprehensive strategy.
Yeah,
but not as a standalone approach. So yeah, I do feel like if people go all in, I feel it. I've definitely been there as well, where when I heard about the vagus nerve, I'm like, whoa, this is like a huge missing piece. And you want to hit the ground running with it. So I remember gargling like so hard. And then like Datis Karazian's thing is like getting to tearing.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, I've found that that's even hard, like for most people to get to tearing. Or at least like visual tears. They can kind of feel that there's tearing, like that they're getting more moisture. But that's like a hard thing. I know for my individual journey, that was a hard point to try to reach. So I'm like, I've just got to do it harder and get the gargle going, and then I'll have this tearing, which again, like for me wasn't, I could tear with other vagal approaches, like gagging, but not like I really struggled with gargling, which just was not happening. I could feel a little more moisture, but not like a tear.
Yeah, and I wonder too, like, and I will say, I was going to point out at one point that I really credit Datis Karazian with the popularity of vagal nerve stuff the last few years, because he's been the most vocal and like talking about it on summits and in his book. And I really think that he's brought it more to the mainstream, to his credit. I think, my one hesitancy, and maybe this is like my brain lesion as a practitioner and as a human, I try to minimize therapeutics that are genuinely unpleasant or like borderline traumatic. So I don't know, the thought of like gargling really, really hard, trying to get to tears and like forcing it that much, like that just doesn't appeal to me very much as a person or a practitioner, because it kind of, I don't know, it all kind of lines up with that idea of like forcing the vagus nerve to do something. Right. And I don't know, something about that has never really resonated with me either. I don't want my patients to look back on their healing journey with me as a practitioner and think like, yeah, that sucked. She was the crazy lady who made me gargle until I cried every night. So I don't know. Admittedly, I do tend to be more of like a mother hen in all aspects of my life, and like, you know, be gentle with my baby ducklings and like the nurturing. So like, maybe I just need to get over it and tell people to suck it up and do hard things more frequently. But I don't know if that's going to be one. I have had patients, you know, going back to, you know, having the hard conversations and not just relying on like a fancy pill or an essential oil or a TENS unit to stimulate your vagus nerve for you and force it. That is way easier. It's way easier for us to tell somebody, just use this TENS unit and your SIBO is cured, or just use this essential oil or whatever, and your vagus nerve will be great. That's way easier than having a conversation with somebody and saying, hey, how's your marriage? Like, sounds pretty not good. Like, I've had patients where I've thought, oh, you would be a lot healthier if you got a divorce. Yeah. And it's so tough. I don't have it in me to have that conversation. And I part of me regrets that because I do think, honest to God, there's some people I can think of right off the top of my head. I guarantee they would be healthier if they could just like get through a divorce and like separate from their spouse.
Right.
But also, I don't know. I can't be the one to point that out to somebody. Maybe someday I will, but you know, that's tough to have that kind of a conversation, or like somebody says that they hate their job like a lot and that they, you know, get IBS when they have to do like a work-related trip or something. And it's like, maybe you need a new job. Like, that's hard. It's so much easier and it's so much more appealing to give somebody a pill or a TENS unit and say, there you go, you're going to be in parasympathetic before you know it. But if they go home and they use that TENS unit laying in bed next to a spouse that they hate or who makes them anxious or like is hypercritical, it's not going to do a damn bit of good. So, I don't know.
Right.
It's tough. It's tough.
Right. I know I've definitely had clients who I can just tell by the comments about their spouses or relationships in general that I'm just like, oh no, like this is... It's, I think, disheartening as a practitioner because, again, it's really totally out of our control. Like, there's only things that we can control. And I think even if we were to, like, plant a seed in some gracious way, it would still, again, be up to the person to actually realize that they need to move on or that they'd be happier outside of a new job. Yeah. So you're 100% right. I'm thinking of a client particularly in my head who, like, every time we chatted, she'd literally like be cussing out her husband and like whispering, and like her husband like didn't know she was working with me. It was just like it was really bizarre. It you could tell there was so much stress coming from that situation, but again, I don't feel like it's my place most of the time to be like, even though it's affecting health. And I do think the gargling thing's interesting. I definitely utilized that more when I first was working with clients, and I still have it as an option of a way to activate the vagus. But I will say compliance is usually pretty low with gargling. It's not something that people look forward to doing. Typically, singing and humming is easier and more enjoyable for people to do as like an activity, from what I've found. Even things like certain breath work tend to be more enjoyable.
Meditation, so those are, yoga.
So I think, again, usually from what I've found, I've moved more away from gargling, but I usually am like, you know, gargling works if you want to try that too. So I might give them some different options, but yeah, I haven't seen it be an overly compliant area, and it's probably like what you're saying, just it's not necessarily an enjoyable process. And I usually try to pair vagal exercises with meals as well. Like, I try to, if they're gonna do breath work, and I don't necessarily say like it's not helpful if you do it outside of a meal, because then sometimes they're like, oh, I forgot to do it. And then I just like don't. And I'm like, well, that's okay.
On me.
Right. And I'm like, that's okay. Like, it's not a big deal. You can do it outside of a meal. But you might get like a little bit more benefit if you do it before a meal, just to kind of settle your system down for a minute. It's the gargling thing is a little bit tricky from what I've seen as a practitioner. It's not necessarily an enjoyable or fun practice.
Yeah, it's not fun. That's why I lean away from that one in particular. I just think, like, would I do it? Probably not. Like, I might do it like diligently for a week,
right,
and give it a go, and then I would give up probably if it was me. But luckily, you know, the vagus nerve is the longest nerve in the body. It's the vagabond. It's the wandering nerve. So there's enough potential to stimulate it in different ways that it's okay. You don't have to gargle. In my experience, you don't have to gargle. You could do other things. I'll share this too. Like, we mentioned a couple off the hand, but I just want to clarify, like, some of the ones that we've already started talking about, like breath work, meditation, yoga, like, there's actually research studies to show that those things improve vagal nerve tone. So I'm not just rattling off like hippy dippy nonsense stuff. It's like these actually have studies. And one, like a really good overarching resource, I don't know if you use this blog very much, but the blog or the website Self Hacked.
I've seen that.
Yeah, they have a really useful article about things that stimulate the vagus nerve. I forget how many there are. It's like, you know, 19 ways to stimulate the vagus nerve.
Yeah.
And if you just type into Google, self-hacked, all one word, vagus nerve, you should be able to pop up that article. And they will link to some of the studies and like give a little bit more of an overview as a starting point. So if you want that as a resource, anybody who's listening, I would encourage you to read that. But they go through like some of these things that we've known are good for us. We know that meditation is good for us. And yet, you know, we have some data that might nudge you more towards a, oh, I need to prioritize this. And I think just anything that gets you in that like rejuvenated, restful state is going to be good for the vagus nerve. And I'll share, I don't know if this has research, but I'll share this anyway. There was a conference that I attended virtually over the summer. And one of the guys, I forget his name, but some big like IFM dude, he's lectured for the IFM for a while. He was doing his talk and he had got diagnosed with cancer. I forget the type, but he got diagnosed with cancer in the last year or so. And he's been undergoing both conventional and natural treatment for it. And he did a talk about his journey basically with cancer. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he mentioned was that he had gotten an Oura Ring, which we've talked about briefly before, but it measures your heart rate variability, which is thought to be a reflection of your sympathetic or parasympathetic state, so your vagal tone. And, you know, he was monitoring that as a part of his cancer journey because there's data that supports increased heart rate variability is associated with better cancer outcomes and, like, survival. So he's been monitoring his HRV for a while. And he said, one of the things that struck me from his talk, he said, you know, at some point, he was, you know, he's taking herbs, he was doing whatever, he was eating right, but he started going down, they have like a creek in the back of their property, like down, you know, through a field in the woods, like a bona fide, you know, little oasis. And he said in the spring, he started walking down there and he would just play at the creek for like an hour a day. And he, you know, he was like, I was like building little things out of the sticks and the stones. And I was like making a dam and, you know, and like skipping rocks. And he's like, I was playing in the water like I would when I was a kid, right? Like I was just like childish play, just kind of futzing around and having fun. And he said, when he started doing that, his HRV shot up and got so much better. It within like days or a week. And I thought, isn't that freaking cool that just playing? And like, I don't know if it's a combination of the outdoors or the the unstructured time in your life, like just having unstructured time where I could do what I want to do and not answer to somebody, like that is incredibly wonderful, I find. Or if it was, you know, the water, I don't know what element it was, but for him, he noticed a drastic change in his HRV when, for the better, I will add, when he started to just like play in a creek out back in his yard. And I thought that was really cool. So that probably is also facilitating vagus nerve function and improving vagus nerve tone.
Right. No, I think, again, there's so many different elements of that that could be helpful for the vagus. The play, the light, the outdoor light, the unstructured time. When you were talking about a creek, I just wanted to be like, don't drink the water. Don't drink the creek water.
Exactly.
I think that's going to come up in every podcast that we do.
Yeah, we need to
make
t-shirts for the podcast.
Right.
Yeah, it'll be a t-shirt one day.
Right. But no, that's really cool. You'll have to dig up the name. The one I keep on thinking it's Jeffrey Bland, but I don't think it's him.
No, no. I should know his name. He actually lives in Asheville, North Carolina, so...
Oh, cool.
It starts with an H. I'm going to Google it right now because it's going to bother me. He's in Asheville. Why can't I think of this? And he's like a big guy with the IFM. I heard him lecture at the IFM before. I'll have to look it up.
Yeah, you'll have to let me know.
Yeah, I won't bore the podcasters with my Googling of things, but his name starts with H, something like that. Last name, that is. But anyway, moving on. So basically anything that relaxes you or lets you take a freaking chill pill or brings you joy probably has the ability to improve vagal nerve tone. So again, mm-hmm. like painting the picture of what not to do again, you could have a person who is gargling their little heart away or using a TENS unit or trying to boss around their vagus nerve, but then, you know, they're stuck in a miserable commute that they hate, going to work for a boss that they hate, and like they're always rushed and they don't have time, and like they're kind of like meh on their spouse. It's like these are the things, like is the vagus nerve work going to make a profound impact for that person? But if that same person like makes some shifts in their life, even if it's not getting a divorce or getting a new job, which are huge life changes, even if it's like have a hobby, like schedule some time in your life and just draw a line in the sand and tell your employer, tell your spouse, whatever, like, this is me time. I'm going to get acupuncture once a week. I'm going to do painting. I'm going to go, you know, out on a lake. I'm going to do something for myself 2 hours once a week. Hard no to everything else, but just like have some structured time in your life. I find that if you don't schedule time for yourself, it's not going to happen, because there's always a million things that you could be doing and emails you could be answering. But if you know, like, okay, Friday I leave early, or Thursday I leave early at 3 o'clock because I have a yoga class at 4 o'clock that I go to in Midtown, whatever, like have that on the calendar and make that your time, and don't let anybody else mess with that. Because that's really what will actually do good things for your vagus nerve, I think.
Right. And I think that usually areas that I focus in on, and you've hit the nail on the head with them, are like connection. Mm-hmm. So how connected is someone? And lots of times if you're struggling with SIBO and IBS, it's very easy to disconnect.
Yeah.
Because you're either having symptoms, or you don't want to go to that restaurant, or parties give you stress if there's not food for you. Yeah. And I get that because I've been there. But even if there's situations that you don't necessarily enjoy, and it's just going to be that way for a little bit, like as you're moving forward and with your gut health, finding other ways to connect that aren't necessarily food related. Mm-hmm. It's harder now with COVID. I think COVID's definitely frying some vagus nerves. So I think I always zero in on connection, whether it's like to your immediate family or mm-hmm. if there's just a need to connect more. And then I think what you're saying too, like hobbies and having like me time, that's not necessarily connecting to someone else, but connecting to yourself in a way, it can be really powerful. I definitely would recommend getting a puppy. We were talking about that before this call, how now I got one puppy and I want to get more puppies.
I fully endorse this.
Right. My husband did not. So Nikki is telling me yes. I need to get some more yeses on my side.
Everybody comment in the YouTube below. Say yes. Yes, Amy, get that other puppy.
Right. So I think that, again, puppy's been interesting for me personally, just because I was the holdout, didn't want to get a puppy. And I know, I was the holdout. I was like, I've never had a puppy, so I just
thought
didn't know.
I knew you.
I know.
Continue.
Okay. So we got the puppy, and I'm like obsessed with it. Every morning we have like a routine that I do where I like kind of wake him up nice, rub him all down. Like, I don't try to rush him to like go outside to pee. I just kind of give him some rubs for like 5 to 10 minutes. He finally gets up and goes pee, and then we go by his food bowl, and usually I'll fill up his food bowl, and before he eats, he'll get a toy and just sit in my lap for like 10 minutes. And
now
then
food bowl has food in it, and your dog is willingly, oh my gosh. See, we've had beagles, and a beagle would never do that in 1,000 years.
And I will say, sometimes he'll like go and get a mouthful of food and then come and sit on my lap until he's done chewing, and he might go get another mouthful and sit back on my lap.
That's adorable. Not at all what I'm familiar with beagles. Oh, man.
Well, again, it's great, though. We have, like, this little flow to our... But it, like, starts my day off in a very relaxing way versus just, like, getting into, like, my, like to-dos, getting breakfast done.
Yep.
So it like starts my morning out slow and like nice.
That's nice.
So again, sometimes even just, we always think about like the meditations and the breath works, like all these really sort of structured stress management, vagal toning activities. But I think you're exactly right, looking at it from a broader standpoint of how is your environment, what everything in your environment that could be conducive to strengthening your vagus
exactly.
is really important to pay attention to.
Yeah, and I really feel like the vagus nerve particularly is just a canary in the coal mine situation where like it's going to show symptoms and it's going to show dysfunction based on the world around it, and like it's your job then, if that, if you go in the coal mine and the canary dies, it's your job to figure out why and then get the heck out of that situation if you need to. So you need to figure out like, oh, my vagus nerve is crapping out on me. I mean, that sounds very harsh and like I'm blaming the vagus nerve, but you know what I mean. Like, okay, my vagus nerve is not doing such a hot job. What around me is making it not do such a good job? And what is in my power to change? Again, it might not be in your power to get a new job right away, but just kind of looking at that as much as possible and like being open-minded to change for the sake of the vagus nerve, I think is really useful.
Yeah.
I think there are people who haven't been in a good like parasympathetic state for probably their entire lives too. So for some people, it can feel really foreign and actually kind of scary to get into more of a parasympathetic state.
Yeah. They're like almost like adrenaline junkies.
Yeah.
Sort of like they like that feeling. And I feel like I'm sort of somewhat like that. I mean, definitely way better than I used to be. Like I know that my system's a lot calmer than it used to be, but even like my parents, I feel like are definitely like the going all out 110%, not slowing down. Like that's kind of how I was raised. So it's very easy to get sucked up in that. And I think because I did so many sports growing up, I actually think that that really stressed my body out in a lot of ways. Because I don't think I was really, not intentionally, but fueling properly during the times of like going all out on like two a days with certain sports and things like that, which just it was too much. But I did want to comment too on your assessment of it being the canary in the coal mine, because it's almost like everything in the gut health space where there's so many layers to everything. So okay, you're diagnosed with SIBO, what does that mean? What motility processes are breaking down? Do you have digestive insufficiencies? Oh, okay, like once you can kind of uncover those things, so it's like maybe you have some vagus nerve issues that's at play with your SIBO. Well, then you got to dig deep. Like there's all these layers.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we're stopping too early without digging deep enough. And I think that's with everything in the gut health space. It's just like you almost have to keep digging. And it feels at times that you're at the root cause of it, but there's probably more layers underneath.
Yeah. And I, to some extent, I blame the internet and also functional medicine for this too, because I think that, well, the internet, because it's the internet, let's face it. But like I've observed with the functional medicine space, like going to conferences and listening to experts and like looking at their blog posts over the years, and I think functional medicine intrinsically has become this like well-oiled marketing machine. Like it's a term now that more people recognize, and there's like a very intentional effort, largely on the part of the IFM, but other groups as well, that like they want, you know, like recognition, like they want everybody to know what functional medicine is and like go out and see people, and it's lovely. But also like I do feel like it can get kind of watered down to some of these bullet points. You know, it's like when like Mark Hyman is going on The Doctors or the Dr. Oz show or whatever, like we get these reoccurring things with any profession or any technique. And with functional medicine, I really feel like the, you know, the bright, shiny testing is one of the kind of facets or pillars of it. And also this like root cause thing. Like you listen to any like IFM speaker or a segment on a TV show or a segment on the news, I guarantee they will say the words root cause at least 5 times in the segment, which is lovely. But also I've noticed that like a lot of people in the space will say that leaky gut is a root cause, or SIBO is a root cause, or estrogen dominance is a root cause. It's like, actually, but no. I mean, like, you know, it's like you're past the trunk and you're getting to like the biggest part of the roots, I guess. Like if you look at a tree, you know, you're getting to the roots. It's like the beginning of the root, but you need to get to the root of the root.
Right.
And trace it back. Like, okay, yes, SIBO is technically the correct diagnosis for your IBS, so it's a root cause, kind of. But why did you get SIBO? If we're blaming the vagus nerve, why is the vagus nerve crapping out on you? Like, you have to trace it back until you get to what is actually happening. And I do feel like my profession is more liberal with the term root cause than maybe would otherwise be helpful. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I wholeheartedly agree. I think in general, we've sort of voiced some complaints about the functional space. And I think even sometimes, like, I would, like, consider myself, like, a part of the functional and integrative space, but there's a lot of, like, frustrations that I know we've sort of aired our grievances about, which, again, the more I'm in it, the more frustrated I get with it. Yeah. And it's just like, and I do think the frustrating part too is that even if you go to a functional medicine doc personally, so it's not just these like as a whole functional medicine or Mark Kreiman going on the doctors or like these articles being shared everywhere, but even if you go to a functional doc, they'll say individualized care or like root cause approach, and that's what people are really wanting, but then the protocols are very cookie cutter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've observed that too. I've seen, you know, if I get, you know, 2 patient referrals from like a particular, I'm just gonna like pull an example out of nowhere. Like if I get like 2 referrals from another practitioner who does like integrative or functional OBGYN work, you know, 2 people can be diagnosed with estrogen dominance and have the exact same protocol.
Right.
Or like, or I know a guy in town too, and he's very smart and he does functional neurology as well, but like the functional medicine piece of what he does literally, and like he's told me this too.
Yeah.
But literally every single patient, he puts them on the autoimmune protocol diet, and every single person does the repair and clear protocol from Apex Energetics. End of story. And then, and it's like, I think that helps a lot of people. And yet, it's incredibly cookie cutter. And you can't really call it functional medicine at that point. So that kind of drives me bonkers too. But anyway, we're getting off the topic. We could always rant about my profession later on. But I think, you know, there's no perfect people and there's no perfect groups and there's no perfect professions. I mean, I could go on totally separate rants about chiropractors or acupuncturists or herbalists or whatever. But there's, you know, I think it's worthwhile to have a conversation about like the relative strengths and weaknesses of each profession and like where you know, where they're at, because then people can make informed choices and like find somebody who actually is thinking a little bit more outside the box instead of just like saying that they think outside the box. Because there's an awful lot of showboating in the modern world because the internet makes that really easy to do. But anyway, back to the vagus nerve though. So that was a tangent. May I tell you a little bit about the TENS unit thing? And then I would like to discuss,
I'd love to hear that,
supplements a little bit. I really think that, honest to God, 90% of the work for the vagus nerve needs to be getting your affairs in order so that you're not frying your vagus nerve on a day-to-day. That's most of it. But for those people who, like, here's one of the areas where I will use the TENS unit a lot, is the patients who come to me and they're like, I react to everything. Like any herb or any supplement or any vitamin or any food that you try to introduce to my system, I'm going to reject it, right? Like I'm going to get a rash or I'm going to throw up or I'm going to do whatever. like those people who have all of the allergies and all of the autoimmunity and like all of that reactivity, and they're like, I feel like they come in to see me and they're like, good luck, because all of your tools, you know, the food, the herbs, the supplements, like, good luck, because you can't use any of those. Those are the people where I really start thinking, okay, I need to do something that doesn't involve you ingesting things. So this is where I'm going to be more, A, thinking like lifestyle and stress kind of stuff and life habits, but also, you know, can we do something like vagus nerve work, exercise? Or sometimes I joke with patients, let's get creative with enemas. Like, maybe we put something in the other end and get a therapeutic effect that way. Like, there's a lot of different options. But what I will share is that the vagus nerve stim with the TENS unit, I would say, I'm going to give you like a couple of bullet points, but not enough to actually do this at home. And I know that's probably a bummer for people, because you're probably watching this podcast and thinking, son of a gun, like, I want to do this now. But the thing is that it is a TENS unit. It is a medical device, so I don't really feel comfortable, and it's probably a liability to, like, give you all of the tools to do this. So I'll give you just, like, a general walkthrough. But basically, a TENS unit, very often you will get exposure to this in a physical therapy office or a chiropractor's office, because the way I was taught to use a TENS unit is in my PT classes, we were taught to use it for muscle pain and muscle tension. Like, oh, you have tense low back muscles, you get one of these bad boys. And I'm going to try to not use a lot of visuals since I know we have people listening to audio only, but it comes with these sticky pads. You usually get four of them, and you get these sticky electrode pads. And say if you have low back pain, then you would position these sticky electrode pads on the muscles of your low back. And then you've got these wire leads that plug into a little device, and it makes a like shocky, shocky, tingly, tingly feeling in the muscles. And it, depending how you set it, you can make the muscles contract and then relax and contract and relax. And it can be helpful for musculoskeletal pain and like tension. So that's how we're all taught to use it in school. What has come about more recently and is very useful is that the vagus nerve has an extra little bonus branch called the auricular branch that goes to the ear. Lord only knows why, but it does. So we've got this little wussy branch that picks up sensory information from the ear, like that little piece of cartilage in front of your ear, the tragus, or I'm sorry, the tragus, right? The front piece of that ear, and also like the inner part of the ear canal. So what I'll do with patients when I'm doing the TENS unit, and they've gotten a lot cheaper now, like a TENS unit with an ear clip is probably like $40, honestly. Mm-hmm. So it's not bad, but I'll tell them to go home. I'll give them instructions. You put one sticky pad just on your neck to complete the circuit, and then you can get ear clips, and you can clip the thing on your ear, and then that makes the tingly, tingly, shocky, shocky feeling on your ear. And all you want to do is you want to get some sort of sensory perception from your ear, and that's all there is to it. I don't think you really need to worry all that much about the settings. I mean, like, I follow what they've done in some research studies, so I always set it the appropriate way. But honestly, in this sense, you really just want some sensory perception going from your ear to your brain, and the vehicle it uses to get there is your vagus nerve. And that's all there is to it. So it does work really well for many people. Some people don't feel anything from it. I think it's a really good indication if you do this that it's working if you get sleepy. So I would say 70 or 80% of my patients that I recommend this to will report that they get sleepy after they do it. And so I always have people do this in the evening before bed. And that way, like, you know, if you start nodding off, no big deal. You're already in bed, you're in your jammies, whatever. And then it can actually promote a more restful night's sleep. But if you think about the parasympathetic, it's the rest and digest side of the nervous system. So it's going to make you want to rest. There are other people who will do vagus nerve stim like this and not feel that. Unfortunately, I'm one of those people. I played with it. I could do it in the middle of the day. It doesn't make me sleepy, which makes me think maybe it's not the most effective thing for my vagus nerve. And it's probably like stress in my life and stuff like that that I need to be more mindful of. But it's a really good indication if you get sleepy from doing it, I think.
Cool.
But yeah, that's in a nutshell. Like I said, I won't go into all of the details. It's probably a liability to do so anyway, but it can be really helpful.
Yeah, and avoid the liability.
Yeah, but if you have, you know, if you have like even like a physical therapist or a chiropractor, even if they don't know anything about this, they could probably help you set the machine to the appropriate settings. But I would encourage you to go slow if you do try it out.
Yeah, I've had a number of clients who have used a TENS unit before, and they've all seemed to like it. I mean, the ones that I remember using it. So yeah, I've just never been like trained on how to set that up and how to do it. But I've always been intrigued by it, so I'm glad you were giving some deets out.
Yeah,
but not all the deets, right?
Yeah, not all the deets. Sorry, guys. and I think it's not intrinsically dangerous.
Right.
Although I will say for record too, when you do the vagus nerve stim with the ear, you actually want to do the left ear only, because the right vagus nerve goes to the heart as well as the rest of the innards, and the left does not. It goes past the heart and it just goes into the innards. So, you know, just in case you don't want to induce some weird like arrhythmia or, you know, something weird like that and mess with your heart rate. So I would say you want to do left side only if you were to do something. And honestly, here's another kind of fun one. If I feel like people are not ready for that vagus nerve stim and I want to give them a stepping point before they start with like the 1 or 2 minute of stim, I'll actually tell my patients to put their finger in their ear lightly and then like twizzle their finger around a little bit like this. Because again, all you're doing is you're getting sensory perception. You want your nerves to think, ooh, I feel something on the ear right now. And that perception of, ooh, I feel something, is going to relay back to the brain via the vagus. So you can actually stimulate it on the free with virtually no risk by just putting your finger very lightly in your ear and just kind of moving it around and twizzling it around. And that can do something too.
The old finger in the ear twizzle.
I don't recommend wet willies as much. Yeah. I think, you know, use a dry finger, and also don't like scratch the heck out of your ear. If you have, long fingernails, you might want to rethink this. But as somebody who keeps my nails pretty short, I could theoretically do this out the wazoo. But yes, that's for what it's worth.
Cool.
I think supplements is probably a whole nother one that we could get into. And I think maybe we'll try to keep it a little bit on the briefer side so we don't make this like a 3-hour-long podcast episode. I'm curious if you have any supplements or any tricks up your sleeve, or I have a couple of opinions on supplements for the vagus nerve, but I'll kick it back to you. Do you have any favorites or any other like modalities or interventions?
I think, again, mainly things that I'm looking out for from a nutrition side of things are things like thiamine. Just from an overall nervous system standpoint, and so many of the clients I work with, if they're avoiding things like grains and beans and like really high thiamine sources in the diet, and they're not replacing those, and it's hard to replace them if you're cutting a lot of different foods out. So I'm always on the lookout for that. Generally, there's things that I like that help just with nervous system function. So I know we've talked about like adaptogens before. But I think that's really helpful for like the whole brain gut axis too, like not necessarily just the vagus nerve. Those are the big ones that I'm thinking of. Other ones, again, we've talked about in the past that just like help calm inflammation in the nervous system. Can be helpful. Again, things like curcumin, resveratrol, omegas, those sorts of things I find are helpful if there's some nervous system inflammation. Those would be the main ones that I think about from a vagal standpoint, or any of the connectivity with the vagus, like the brain and the nervous system in general.
Yeah, and I think you brought up a really good point in that, like proper nutrition, this should go without saying with this podcast, but it does go with saying, is that making sure that you are well nourished and like supplementing for a short period of time if you need to. Like I've had patients who are on such a restricted diet that they have been blatantly thiamine deficient.
Right.
And we do a supplement for a short period of time, like a month or two, just to boost their levels while they're introducing new stuff. I think any of the B vitamins really are up for grabs, because if you think about it this way, Google the symptoms of a vitamin deficiency. And if neuropathy or altered brain function is part of that cascade, you can kind of assume that the vagus nerve is going to be affected, right? So like B12 deficiency will result in neuropathy. Probably doesn't do good things for your vagus nerve either. B1 deficiency very certainly will do that too. And a lot of the symptoms of B1 are like dysautonomia type symptoms, like POTS and like weird blood pressure stuff and like racy heart rate stuff. Like B1 is a big, big, biggie when we're talking about autonomics, which we are with the vagus nerve. Or even something like vitamin B6, if you're B6 deficient, that can cause neuropathy as well. Mm-hmm. So just making sure that you're nutritionally replete, particularly in your B vitamins, is really important. And also, you need to give the nerve the fuel and the substrate it needs to like build new parts of the nerve and like build new neurotransmitters. So making sure that you have the protein and the healthy fats, because nerves are like 70% fat, and making sure that you have good glucose levels and you're not swinging all over the place. You know, that's why they call Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes now. Wacky blood sugar just wrecks your nerve function, and the vagus nerve is almost certainly included in that. So just the really like foundational stuff, like make sure you're not blatantly hypothyroid, make sure you're not blatantly anemic or iron deficient. A lot of the holistic kind of stuff, I know it gets boring after a while that we talk about it so much, but a lot of the good old standbys like blood sugar, iron, B vitamins, like protein, like those are still really relevant, even if you are tempted to get like laser focused on the vagus nerve.
Right. I think it's interesting you bring up iron as well. I feel like we could do a whole episode on iron deficiency.
We shall.
Because
we shall.
That's definitely one I see, like, I mean, probably in most of the iron panels that I'll like say, oh, you should just have your doctor run this iron panel. All the time is low. And it can be tricky with gut issues, like bringing it back up. So that would be a really good topic for us to cover. But you're 100% right. And I even think, I mean, we've talked about this a lot too, so we're beating a dead horse. But overall nutrition, if you're under eating and your body then like is using things like the health that you might be eating some healthy fats and eating protein, but if it's not enough, you don't have extra resources to rebuild your body's in the state of just breaking things down all the time. And it just is going to stress your body out. And as I've said a number of times on this podcast, it's something that I see so many of my clients doing and not addressing because they're in this space which I've been in too, where it's like just removing foods, like I'm reacting to this, like so hyper focused on the diet piece but they're missing the nutrition piece. And if you're not eating enough, that's going to stress out your nervous system as well.
And I almost imagine it like very simplistic, like if we were to kick it back old school, like 50,000 years, I don't know like what time frame. I'm not a history buff, but if we were to kick it back way back to like the good old days when we were, you know, hunter and gatherer societies, to your nervous system, there's almost like two main modes, right? You could either be out there chasing the wildebeest and like fueled by adrenaline and cortisol, and like that's the fight or flight mode, is you're running from the bear or you're chasing the wildebeest, one or the other. Or you're chasing a meal or somebody else thinks that you are a meal is another way to think of that. So that's the yin to the yang, or you are home in your cave eating the meal that you just caught. Like those are the two scenarios that your very primitive, you know, midbrain sees. And if you can try to convey one or the other intentionally, like so many of us are in these lousy situations of like a lot of stress or financial difficulty or a marriage that sucks or a job that sucks or whatever. And we're constantly just like fueled by adrenaline and cortisol. So of course our nervous system is not going to get the memo that we want to break down the food. And also if you're in that mode of under eating, this is the segue if you're wondering, if you're in this mode of under eating chronically, your brain, like you might think that you're telling your brain that you're at home in the cave eating the whatever you just caught. But if your brain is perceiving a lack of calories, your brain also knows, oh, she's going to need to like go chase down a new wildebeest any minute because we're starving. So it's like, You might think that you're in rest and digest, but if you're really under eating chronically, you're also giving this mixed message to your nervous system of like, yeah, I'm eating and we're home at the cave eating the whatever, but also I probably need to go out and find more food because we're starting to starve and, you know, that's not good. So like, we need to go out and hunt again. So we need that cortisol and that adrenaline and that sympathetic tone. So I think under eating can play a big role.
I think that that's really accurate. And I also think that sometimes when I talk to people and we're talking about building calories up, it can feel a little bit, people, again, like we were talking about, want to get better yesterday. That whole process of changing how the body is going from that fight or flight state, like let's say you've been under eating for a year and we're working on it, that's not like an overnight switch. Like if you start eating again and eating enough, which is a great first step, but it has to be consistent enough to where the body feels like this isn't just a fluke.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that's going to be, you're going to get enough nutrition for here on out so that it can operate effectively. So I would say too, if you're someone that knows like, oh, I might not be getting enough calories, I need to focus on adding some food in to calm down my nervous system and to get more into a rest and digest state, I would have some patience with that process and understand there might be some growing pains with it as well, like with kind of adding some food in. I do find that sometimes the process of adding calories in, and this is why it's probably important to work with someone too, to know what's a normal part of that equation. Sometimes you might need to add some digestive support with it. You also might need to change around meal structure and focus on like volume of things you're eating to try to get more calories in. But I just wanted to point out that, you know, it might take some time to rebuild that feeling of rest and digest long term. It's not going to be like that immediate switch, like the second you start eating well again.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to how intelligent your body actually is. Your body, I'm just imagining, like, if you've been under eating for a year and then you have like 3 days of eating more food, your body on some level might be like, ha ha ha, you're not bamboozling me. The whole switcheroo. No. I'm not going to do that yet. And it still thinks it needs to like conserve and be in that state of more sympathetic, we need to go hunt another wildebeest kind of stuff. So it is, you have to basically work your way past that resistance where the body thinks like, hey, she's trying to trick me.
Right.
This doesn't seem like what we've known for the last X amount of time. And it could be that you've been in that state for years or decades even. But like, if you think about it that way, your body is just, it's like your brain's a big supercomputer. Mm. And your nervous system is just observing the world around it and picking up on patterns and then trying to make sense out of those patterns. And if 99.9% of the pattern has been starvation mode, and then you're just starting with that 0.1% of, hey, no, it's okay, we have calories and stuff, it might take a little bit of time to shift that in your favor.
Yeah. I always think of it, too, with like dieting. So this is outside the realm of gut health, but I still see it in my gut health clients if they've been like more dieting for a long time, like yo-yo dieting. Mm-hmm. They can oftentimes have some weight gain as we're adding in calories. Mm-hmm. Their metabolism has probably been running in a way where they're trying to conserve fuel, as you were mentioning, like they're trying to conserve everything that's coming in. And I know with some of the clients I've worked with, that's very frustrating because maybe they don't want to gain weight. But I'm like, this is kind of, it has to be part of the process of your body finding a new or rebooting the metabolism again, because you know, probably eating 1200 calories a day if you're an active individual, I think in general is probably too low, but especially if you're active, it's just going to be problematic from a metabolic overall function standpoint. So getting over that hump again, your weight might change. You might feel, especially in the early like couple of weeks, sometimes there's like some blood sugar swings I've seen too, if we're adding like carbs in as well. as the body's trying to regulate different fuel sources, but it can be a little bit of a hairy, like a dicier transition if you're not sure what you're doing. And even if you do know what, even if you do feel confident with your plan, there could still be like a little bit of bumps in that process. So I would just be patient with it and really just focusing on getting your body in a better and nourished state, and keeping that on the forefront of the mind. And again, working with someone helps as well.
I think so. And it could be honestly triggering to add new foods in for some people. So just kind of like being mindful of that and being kind to yourself and checking in and saying, oh, hey, like this is actually really like a lot for me to deal with. I don't know, just giving yourself that space and that ability to heal and knowing when you need help and reaching out to somebody who knows what they're doing and has sympathy and knowledge around what you're dealing with. But I will say, let's see, to get back on the vagus nerve train, I mean, we were talking about vagus nerve stuff, but just a little bit rabbit traily. To go back to the topic of supplements really briefly, too, I think adaptogens and Nervines, like ashwagandha and holy basil and ginseng, like stuff like that is going to be wonderful for the vagus nerve typically. Again, like if you're totally fried and like in situations that make you depleted, I don't know if it's going to be the end all be all to like take ginseng and think that it's going to like give you energy and like revitalize you. You might have to take away some things in your life as well. But the adaptogens and the Nervine herbs are really wonderful. And I do want to do an episode entirely dedicated to each of those topics eventually. So those I think can be useful. You touched on the anti-inflammatories because nerves don't like inflammation. So that could be a potential useful supplement for vagus nerve function. And then funny enough, so today you had texted me a product and we're like, hey, have you heard of this? And we had gone back and forth via text a little bit briefly, but let's remind me, what was the name of that thing that
It's
you?
called Parasym Plus.
That's right. That's right. And I'm gonna
I've
pull it
had,
up.
and I've had a couple people ask me about it, and I just was not aware of it. So I figured I'd throw it your way and see if you had heard of it or know much about it.
Yeah, and I hadn't, but when I took a look at it, the thing that really struck me, and I've tried to pull up the ingredients again, but I can't pull it up. The thing that struck me about it is that it looks fairly similar to a product that I was already familiar with from Apex Energetics called Acetyl CH Active. And basically, both of these products, either the Parasym Plus product or Acetyl CH, theoretically could work on the vagus nerve to some degree. Again, I think that it's, the canary in the coal mine situation. If you're trying to like force your vagus nerve to work, you're probably not going to get very far. But Amy, did I ever tell you about the time I accidentally discovered a prokinetic?
No.
So this happened in grad school, and that it wasn't until just a couple years ago that I realized like kind of what I had stumbled on. So like, right, there's all these prokinetics that are available on the market. There's prescriptions. And then we have like the general, Motil Pro, Motility Activator,
Right.
5-HTP, ginger, artichoke, some combination thereof. And a lot of them look mighty, mighty similar. And they're trying to do kind of similar things. When I have patients test out different prokinetics, one of the ones that I have them try is Acetyl CH Active. It's not marketed for that purpose whatsoever. It's marketed by Apex as like, more of like memory support, temporal lobe support, like acetylcholine pathway in the brain kind of support. But I accidentally discovered it was a prokinetic myself. So long story short, I had taken acetyl CH, I think when I took boards one, like a bunch of us, we were all cramming for the test and we were nervous. And I was getting into the functional medicine geekery, and Datis said it was good for memory. So I was like, I'm going to try this. Sure, why not? So my roommate and I got like a bottle of acetyl CH, and we took that for a while. And I didn't notice anything profound from it at the time, but I don't have a particularly poor memory. Other than names, I suck at names, but otherwise, I'm pretty good with my memory. So I was like, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's not like my weakest link. got through boards one. Everybody passed. Everybody was hunky-dory. About a year later, my friends and I are gearing up for part two of boards because we break it up into chunks as chiropractors. And about a year later, we're getting ready to sit for part two of boards. And I was like, ooh, I'm going to get acetyl-CH active again because why not? Okay. And they had changed the formula over the course of that year. And I didn't realize it or I'd forgotten it. And they made it stronger. So when I started it again, I was like, all right, I had got, you know, Detis always says to play with the dose on that kind of stuff to see the effect. So I think I had gotten to a point where I took like 5 at a time. And I was like, yeah, I'm just going to like pick up where I left off. So I took 4 all at once. I think if I remember, it was 4. So I took 4 all at once, took the pills with breakfast, and I went to school. Well, I started feeling really terrible. I was in a class, and of course it was like the one class, the one teacher where I could not duck out easily. The guy, right. This particular teacher used to be a Marine, and he was one of those teachers that like, and he's this big, like burly, muscly guy. And for all that he was he was a nice guy and he liked me just fine. But I just knew, I was like, if I try to run out of the room, Dr. Losak, hi, if you're listening, Dr. Losak, I just knew, I was like, Dr. Losak is going to be like, where are you going? And he's going to call me out for leaving the room. And I feel horrible. But I was starting to get like mad vertigo and the room was spinning and I was kind of queasy, nauseous. A bunch of my muscles were twitching, like the muscles on my arms and my legs and like my traps, like a bunch of my muscles were twitching. And my gut was just like making a lot of noises. And it was mostly the vertigo, the headache, and like the kind of nausea that was really getting me. But I remember I was like hunched over in my chair, kind of doing this, like trying to hide in my class because I didn't think I could leave. So I was like, I'm just going to sit here for a while. And one of my friends, AJ, like kind of like put his hand. He was like, are you okay? I was like, no, I'm not okay. Yeah. So he's like, okay, you go. I'll cover for you. Like if Dr. Losak, you know, yells at you or whatever, I'll tell him that you're feeling like crap. I'm like, okay, thank you. I made it out of the room and I parked my butt on a bench right outside the room. And then like all the classroom leaves, like everybody comes out of the class. They're like, hey, Nick, what are you doing on the bench? That's weird. Funny enough, that day, Dr. Losak had forgotten that he was supposed to take us to the clinic for our orientation for clinic. So all of a sudden, like it was the weirdest experience because I'm sitting there feeling like crap. And I'm like, okay, I got out of the room. I made it. I'm good. And then out comes my teacher and all of my classmates. And I was like,
oh no.
I was thinking, oh no, he's super pissed. And he's going to like lecture me out here. He wouldn't do that. I don't know why I thought that, but I was like, oh God. And then they all just marched by me and they were like, come on, Nick, we need to go to the clinic. It's orientation. I was like, what? And then similarly, AJ covered for me again. And long story short, I made it home. My friend gave me a ride home and I just laid there in bed with all of my muscles twitching, room spinning, nausea, and my gut going. And I finally had the epiphany. I don't know, like an hour later, I realized, all of these are acetylcholine pathways. Oh my God, I overdosed on the supplement. Because you have acetylcholine pathways in your gut, the vagus nerve, in the muscle, the neuromuscular junctions where you control all of your skeletal muscles. So like your biceps and your triceps and your quads, all of those are acetylcholine run. The vagus nerve is what makes you like queasy and nauseous and like carsick. Like that, the connection of the vagus nerve to your cerebellum is what makes you feel like queasy and carsick and motion sickness, but also it was making me really dizzy and really nauseous. Like everything all of a sudden make perfect sense. And I was like, oh, I'm a dummy. Okay, I'm just going to ride this out. And then sure enough, a couple hours later, it wore off and I was fine. But I thought I was dying. But it wasn't until years later, like literally 10 years later, it was like 2 years ago, I had the epiphany. I was like, wait, that supplement did stuff to my vagus nerve. I know it did because I overdosed on it. And that's why I've been using acetyl-CH active as a prokinetic. It's not marketed that way. But I will tell you, as somebody who overdosed on a similar formulation, I do think it revs up the vagus nerve to some degree. I don't know if I would recommend overdosing like I did, because I took way too much. But that was actually when I realized, I was like, oh. So when I have patients try 1 week of each of the prokinetics, acetyl-CH active is one of the ones I have them try out because for some people that is like the prokinetic of choice and they love it and they don't like the others. for other people, they might like one of the other products. I'm still going to point out, like 50% of people, when I have them speed date all of them, I mean, 50% of people very clearly prefer motility activator. So that is my prokinetic of choice. If you're just like listening, you don't have the ability to try all of them, try motility activator. Like that 50% of people aren't lying. But there's like smaller percentages that like other ones. And acetyl CH is actually the number two. Or number two or number three, depending how you crunch the data. So
it does
help a fair whack of people.
Cool. Yeah, I like motility activator a lot. I'm not a fan of MotoPro.
No, that one has bombed my experiment. Less than 10% of people actually like motility or Motil Pro.
It has so many symptoms too. Like I would say probably most of the people I talk to have some sort of ginger burn as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From it, much less so from motility activator. So
yeah,
I mean, I've even that to me is, so if you're on Motil Pro, you might want to try a different one if you're finding that that's
not helpful. We should take out stock in integrative therapeutics, because we're going to get everybody to buy their stuff on this podcast. I think that, try to enhance motility from that end. Potentially something similar to acetyl CH active or this parasimp, whatever, could be helpful. They're slightly different formulations, but more or less a lot of the same kind of stuff. But supporting acetylcholine and supporting memory, and I'll say this too, one of the things you need to make acetylcholine, the neurotransmitter, is choline. So if you're eating, a vegan diet and you're not eating things like eggs and choline sources, that also could compromise your vagus nerve tone. So you might want to consider having like egg yolks and I don't know, registered dietitian, tell me other foods that have choline. I always just tell people to eat eggs as long as they tolerate eggs.
Yeah, I think things like liver have choline, but again, like that's a harder one. I feel like incorporate in, those would be the big ones that I know of. Again, if you can eat eggs, for sure eat them.
Yeah.
I have a list too. I can pull up with choline. I think sometimes even dairy has it, but again, that could be another harder to break down for certain people. Food group. I think that's really fascinating about the. It's called acetyl CH active. Mm-hmm. Is that what you said? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, acetyl-CH active is the product.
Seems like, I think it's always interesting to me, like, how people come up with the names of their products. Sometimes they're, like, too much, where I'm like, you need to, like, settle down a little bit. And other times they're, like, very much, like, too science-y to where, like, I don't know. We should name supplements ourselves.
We should. After we make the Don't Drink the Creek Water t-shirt, we'll get on that next. Our next project.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, I'll tell you what, Amy. I feel like this was a pretty thorough tour of the vagus nerve and the parasympathetic nervous system. Any closing remarks? Anything to add?
I did want to just ask you, too, just from like a more conventional chiro standpoint, are there any like manual manipulations that, chiros do from a vagal standpoint?
I don't know. Not that I'm aware of. And this, I might get flack from colleagues because I don't do as much of the chiropractic work these days. But not that I know of. What I will say, and I'm glad you brought that back up, is twofold, is that sometimes just standard chiropractic adjusting, I think, can really reset the system really nicely.
Right.
I've never experienced this exactly, but two of my very close friends, like, and I'll use Mamie as an example. Mamie, my roommate in grad school at BFF, very frequently she would go get adjusted. And she tried different types. She went to an AK doctor for a while. She went to an upper cervical person for a while. She did a technique called DNFT for a while, like all different kinds of techniques. And she would go get adjusted. And most frequently she would come home and she would be like, it'd be like 3 p.m. or something. And she'd be like, oh, I'm just wiped. I'm going to take a nap. And it became a running gag because I was like, you're not waking up from the nap. I'll see you in the morning. So she would come home and say, I'm wiped. I'm going to take a nap. And I'd be like, good night. She's like, no, it's a nap. I'm like, good night. See you tomorrow.
Right.
And she would conk out and just sleep for like, I mean, 15, 18 hours all in one stretch. And then she would wake up and she would just be like rejuvenated. And this would happen really frequently with her when she would get adjusted. And she always described it as like this wave of calm and this like tension release for her. That her body just literally felt like it was in parasympathetic again, and she was like, I need to rest. And I always was envious of her because I've never really experienced that from chiropractic. Mm-hmm. But like I've had cervical adjustments where my cheeks blush a little bit and I'm like, ooh, little something something there. You're making me blush. But I haven't gotten like that full body reboot feeling. But I know that Mamie has many times. And then I was talking with another friend on Marco Polo very recently, like 2 months ago, and she went and got adjusted. And then same thing happened to her. She was like, man, I slept like a rock that night. I felt amazing. I feel like I have energy. And we were talking about that. She's like, oh, yeah, like I've gotten that from different types of chiropractic. Like that's how my body reacts to adjustments. And we were talking about how it's probably just getting you back in parasympathetic for the first time in a while. And it's like a hard reboot for your system. So I do know multiple people who have said that for, you know, just chiropractic work. I don't know if there's a special technique that you need to do or seek out, but just right. A good chiropractor might help you with that. I think, you know, we learned the anatomy of the vagus nerve and we learned enough of it, but I don't think in my school, we didn't learn a technique for it. But in functional neurology, which is like the sister, you know, profession to functional medicine, and that's what like Karazian does, for example. In functional neurology, they do talk quite a bit more about vagus nerve tone. And they talk a lot about how like 90% of the brain's activity fires down into the vagal nerve nuclei in the brainstem. Mm-hmm. So also like theoretically, if you have, you know, low dopamine or low serotonin or low GABA or like it not enough activation of certain neural pathways in the brain, or the cerebellum, or if you don't have enough movement, then that can compromise your vagus nerve. So actually, I've noticed too that one thing that can help quite a lot is exercise, particularly if it's vigorous. Yeah. Walking and, you know, light kind of activity doesn't seem to do quite as good of a job, but like exercising and getting your heart rate up and really moving your body will fire up pathways in the brain, and then that will fire up the vagus nerve nuclei. So, and then the you know, functional neurology, like they have a much more thorough like intake process and exam process. And there's like subtleties, you know, looking at the pupils from side to side and seeing if like the sympathetic activity is lopsided from side to side is another conversation they will have. So like the symmetry of vagal nerve firing is something bigger in like the functional neurology space as opposed to like typical chiropractic work. So yeah. That's a whole other topic for another day, but they do talk about the nervous system and the sympathetic and parasympathetic balance quite a bit in functional neurology, which is usually practiced by chiropractors.
Yeah, I know that I've had clients that feel like they get a lot of benefit from just regular adjustments. Mm-hmm. From like a nervous system standpoint.
Yeah.
So I know I've had that conversation with people, so it's interesting just hearing your take on it. And yeah. Mamie, I remember her as your closet meditator friend.
Yes, my closet meditator. My little kid. She's 5 feet tall and I'm 6 feet tall, so she's pipsqueak. I don't know, this will be like a weird note to wrap up on. Did I ever tell you about Big Things, Little Things?
No.
It brings my heart joy.
I can't wait to hear, though.
So, Mamie is very small, and I am very not small. And that amused me from the moment we met. And luckily, she puts up with my, like, very cheesy sense of humor. So, one of the things I forget when I started it, like, a year or two into living together. I've started a photo series that I call Big Things, Little Things. And they are photos of things that represent us. So if I am at, you know, Harbor Freight with my husband or the Home Depot and there's a big hammer and a little hammer, I'll take a picture of them together and be like, it's us.
Aww.
Or like a big wine bottle and a miniature wine bottle. It'd be like, it's us. The ultimate is if you could get both the big thing and the little thing in the same photo and pose with them in a ridiculous way. That's what really is like the cream of the crop. But occasionally I will see just an absurdly large thing or an absurdly tiny thing, and then I have to take a picture of that as a standalone. So like I think 2 years ago, Costco had these teddy bears that were literally like the size of a van.
Oh my
They were
gosh.
huge and unnecessarily huge. And of course I had to pose with that and send it to Mimi. So yes, that's my big things, little things photo series. Hopefully she never tires of receiving them because I will never stop sending them to her. And particularly with the pandemic, as we got outside and went on a lot of family walks, I took a lot of pictures of very tiny flowers for her. Yes,
I love
so
that.
yeah, my little buddy. But anyway, well, I feel like that is a pretty good place to wrap up on the vagus nerve, parasympathetic, sympathetic, everything in between. Lot to unpack, but I think this was a good episode. Hopefully you all agree with us. As always, if you are listening on a podcasting app, if you can rate us 5 stars, share with your friends, share with your neighbors, share in your Facebook groups, that would be great. That'll help us reach more people. And also, if you're on YouTube, go ahead and click the like button, click the subscribe button, leave a comment down in the doobly-doo below. Do all the things that you do on YouTube. All of that helps us grow this channel, grow the podcast, and ultimately heal the world of IBS and SIBO, because there is so much of it. We need to get this information out to more people. So if you could help us spread the word, again, share in Facebook groups or wherever you feel like it would benefit people, I know I sure as heck would appreciate it, and I'm sure Amy would too. So thank you all. And yeah, we'll see you in the next episode where we talk about some other cool topic.